I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider. So before we start, we'd like to give everyone a little introduction to Nick Begich. But one of the things for us, the first time we heard Dr. Nick Begich was back in the mid-90s. Kevin and I were working in the restaurant industry, and we would be driving home late in the evening, probably midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning, and we would hear Dr. Nick Begich on the Art Bell Show. So it's really exciting for us to have him here on our own radio show. We're a little bit intimidated, but that's okay. And what I'd like to do is just read you a little bit from his bio. There's a lot more information at his website at www.earthpulse.com, but I'll just read you a little snippet of that, and then Nick can flesh it out a little bit with some of the things that he thinks everybody needs to know about him. But Dr. Nick Begich is the eldest son of the late United States Congressman from Alaska, Nick Begich Sr., and political activist Peggy Begich. He's well known in Alaska for his own political activities. He was twice elected president of both the Alaska Federation of Teachers and the Anchorage Council of Education. He has been pursuing independent research in the sciences and politics for most of his adult life. Begich received Doctor of Medicine, Medicina Alternativa Honoraris Causa, for independent work in health and political science from the Open International University for Complementary Medicines, Colombo, Sri Lanka, in November 1994. He co-authored with Gene Manning the book Angels Don't Play This Harp, Advances in Tesla Technology. Begich also authored Earth Rising, The Revolution Towards a Thousand Years of Peace, and his latest book, Earth Rising 2, The Betrayal of Science, Society, and the Soul, both with the late James Roderick. So I'm going to stop there because I can just keep reading for another half an hour. But welcome, Nick. Okay. It's great to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me. And it's my pleasure to be with you in Palmer, somewhere close to home for a change. So that's kind of nice.
Yeah. You bet. So what do you have to say about how to get out of the habitual day-to-day grind and become a true innovator and inspired creator of your own day?
You know, I think, I've done that most of my adult life. And and even if you think you're out of the box, as long as I think you still acknowledge there is one, you're probably still in it. So the box maybe gets big, maybe it's small. It's perspective on what you're doing. But I think pursuing your interest is a critical element, and I think most people don't pursue their interest as a way of making a living, so to speak. You end up spending a lot of your time doing things that maybe you don't really care to do, but trying to find that place where your interests follow your income and then where your broader perspective of community and sort of how that fits in, I think that's where the form to life makes it a lot more interesting, and I think most of us get trapped one way or another in the routines of the day, so to speak.
Yeah, it reminds me of a conversation that we had with Hans-Peter Dürer, who's a physicist. He's a an older man. He's probably in his 80s now, and he's
he was the chairman of the Max Planck Institute
in Munich.
In physics.
And we just happened to were at a speech that he gave, and he's a humanitarian now. He goes around and he speaks about world peace. And at the end of his talk, he holds up a piece of string. And he holds us up and he says, "What holds us together?" And it's just really threads all. And so it's just, you take it apart and you just find that these little fibers. And he uses
called it fuzz.
He says fuzz. He says it's fuzz that holds it together. And then his metaphor is that love is basically what holds this whole thing together, in terms of a larger.
But the thing that was really striking for us about the conversation is that he said most people wake up in the morning and they make a Xerox copy of the Xerox copy of the person that they were making yesterday and a Xerox copy of that. And pretty soon you wake up and you check in, okay, who am I? Who are my parents? What's my educational background? What's my cultural conditioning? What's my social conditioning? Who am I married to? What does everybody expect of me? And then they just jump right into that role. And so the question is, how do you not do that?
Well, I was raised where it's kind of the opposite. this idea of self-expression, the idea of really moving into your interests as being sort of the primary reason to live. But it does run counter to a lot of our culture. I think that's true. I think most of us get caught in that sort of the daily grind, daily routine. The breaking out of it, I think, is, again, sort of looking at what are you really interested in. I mean, how many people have we known that have gone through 60 years of that routine, retire, and then pass on in a couple of years and never really explore very much of anything, at least not from the outside looking, you know, looking in. And I think a lot of us can get trapped in that way. I've had the opportunity of, from a very young age, being able to do things without any real limits, not really recognizing too many limits.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Like, how is your background different than?
In terms of my parents, dad, of course, disappeared on a flight when I was mm-hmm. pretty young, which is kind of a sobering sort of experience. At 14, you sort of re-examine what's valuable in terms of how you spend your time, how you look at your effort. And so I made some real conscious decisions then regarding how I would spend my life, because it's one thing you can't really replace is your time. So that realization came pretty early. And then my mom was a pretty free-spirited type of individual, much different than my dad in terms of how she pursued life. The idea of being excited about life, about finding those things that are truly touch you in a way, and yet service was a big part of my family, as anyone who's been in Alaska very long knows. So you kind of look at how do you combine all that, and as a young person growing up, I think when you really work from your center, work from the things that truly interest and excite you, that enthusiasm blows out into your work life. And I think as we're young people, I think we kind of start out that way. You know, you think about how many times do people change their major in, you know, college? A half a dozen sometimes. You know, by the time you get there, you've changed it probably what you were going to do at least that many times. And I think it gets dampened. Just the way our culture runs, the way things sort of come at us, we sort of acquiesce to a smaller version of who we might be. I think that's pretty easy to do. So how do you avoid it? Just don't accept the limits. I mean, that's mm-hmm. simple as said.
Because everybody, your brothers have gone on to do, both of them have done amazing things, you know, that
right.
your average person wouldn't necessarily do. So there's something about, you know, maybe it's something about your upbringing or your life experiences, like what you're saying, that had you see things from a different perspective.
I think so. And my sisters as well, you know, all of us are, you know, we've done a lot of things in our lives that are, again, we pursue what we really love and are passionate about. And in doing that, it really pulls in. We were talking, I know Kevin and I have talked on and off, and Sam and I have talked on and off about this whole idea of how do things create and how do they coalesce. And a lot of it is what you draw to you. You know, you think about your family nucleus and who's there. And, you know, we have six kids in the family, and we've all had a bunch of kids now, too. So I think it's pretty interesting to see how that is on a multi-generational level. But that same kind of enthusiasm for pursuing interests as a sort of primary objective, and doing it with the perspective of also rendering some useful service in the course of
that was life. The thing you said about service. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of emphasis in our culture on finding your bliss or finding your passion
without a higher context.
Yeah,
it's only got so much power, right? It seems like we have a lot more access, greater resources, greater inspiration when it's something much, much greater than our own satisfaction, maybe.
Yeah, I think it's true. And I think you reach a point, at least for me, a point where sort of the larger landscape is a lot more interesting. And, you know, I make my living with my left foot, is the way some of my friends put it. So I do make a decent living, and I'm able to pursue interests, and at the same time have a lot of time to dedicate to sort of other things. And they don't always, you don't always make a living at it, but you do contribute something from it. And you're surprised by the synchronicities of events. Like when you're doing what you're truly passionate about, how that sort of explodes out into your larger community is pretty phenomenal. The synchronicities of events, how things sort of fall your way, and how we draw that to us. You know, this is something that a lot of us don't really consider much in the daily routine of how we live, but sort of setting the framework for the day, looking forward to the things that you do that bring some excitement, even within the routine of getting up, going to work, you know, doing those things that we do, but finding a way to flip the light switch off. You know, one of my children, Forrest, was maybe five or six, and we had this conversation about creativity. And I told him, you know, some weeks before, this sort of quick definition, you know, was it's like switching off the channels on a television. You just change the channel and you can redirect your creativity in a different direction. And I didn't think much of it. And a couple weeks later, I was lamenting over this particular job I had within bureaucracy here in Alaska. And I'd been doing it for a few years, and it was really making a living with your left foot can be really boring sometimes, too. So, and I was expressing that, and he goes, change channels. You know, there's a five-year-old, right, giving you the real knowledge you needed at the time. And that really was what it was about. It was a re-looking at, okay, here I was in this position, providing me my living, didn't tax my creativity too much. It was a bureaucracy, after all, and, you know, as long as you could keep things moving and organize it well, it kind of ran itself. The creative time after work became the place where I really put my effort. And that's when I started writing, when I started really doing the kinds of things that people know me for over the last 15, 16 years. It was, again, sort of taking a look at the base I was using as a springboard for the things that truly interest me, not looking at it as a trap anymore. Yes. And this is the switch. You know, you're not in a trap. You just happen to be where you are right now. It is not who you are. It just happens to be what you're doing right now, but it doesn't necessarily have to define you, and probably doesn't. When you think about the context of your life over a lifetime, no single job or single series of events generally define who you are, although for males particularly, we sort of identify ourselves with our vocation, the work we do. But really, it's just a very shallow, light expression of perhaps who we are, and I think that's the realization of it. Once you kind of accept that sort of standpoint, I guess, or perspective, stepping back from the routine work and looking sort of at what are the things that truly bring out that creative essence, that thing that connects you to all that is, that allows that real creative source to flow in the work we do, or in the things that bring us pleasure, which may not have anything to do with our work at all. The work may just be a means to the end. Put food on the table and do that thing.
Yeah, and it sounds like in what you were saying there, it seems like we can't hold too tightly to who we take ourselves to be or who other people are holding us to be.
That's fair enough. And I mean, growing up in a political family in Alaska, I can tell you, most people think it's like this wonderful silver spoon, and it is truly not. It's a burden in a lot of respects because it gets in the way of a lot of relationships. People come into those conversations with preconceived ideas of who you are, what you're about. And in fact, most of my friends will introduce me by my first name, so I establish a relationship with people before they have any connection to their preconceived idea of who I might be, which is really, when you stop and think about it, we all come to into each other's situation the same way, whether it's in a restaurant and the person who happens to be waiting on us right now, they fall into the role of the waiter or waitress, and we fall into the role of the customer, and yet this is still a human being that certainly isn't defined in their totality as a wait person.
How people can fall into roles really easily and create these artificial limits for ourselves, you know, and we can see each other only through those roles at a certain point. If we're not really present in the moment,
yep,
we can miss what's actually going on in front of us,
yeah,
which is sort of one of the things you were talking about before. There's a couple of things that you mentioned. One was the synchronicities. So I'd like you to maybe speak
right
a little bit about some of those synchronicities over the course of the past 15 years and how some of those things showed up. And the other thing that I want to talk about, too, is just that you're awake enough to notice when those things are happening. And there's a concept in Chinese medicine, we call it, there's a point on the liver channel, it's called Gate of Hope. And what it basically means is when that point is not open, all these possibilities can pass by your field and you'll miss them. So it's
right,
the equivalent of, like, you know, somebody who's working in an office cubicle and all they can see is the four walls and the ceiling, and they can't see when the opportunity comes by. And 10, 15, 20 opportunities could come by, but they're so focused on the fact that they're stuck that they don't see the opportunity. Versus the person who's awake and they're doing the same thing, but they're coming from such a different place that they're aware when that opportunity comes by and they can jump on it.
Yeah, I see that. The awareness piece of it is being able to sort of stand back from your circumstance, observe what you're doing and how you're engaged, but not necessarily defining yourself by it. A year or so ago, I had this really horrendous week. In the same week, I had this really incredible stuff happen to me. In fact, I've said to you guys, it was like the best week of my life and the worst week of my life all in the same week. Not like one thing happening after another, but all happening at the same time. And the recognition in that week for me was how little those high or great times or those really down times, how really little they truly define us as human beings. When we're in the middle of them and we're kind of being washed onto the beach by them, that's sort of one way to fall into our circumstances, and I think most of us do. The other is to sort of recognize those circumstances, step back from them, control what you can and what you can't, recognize, but at least continue to pursue those things that truly invigorate us. Because I think that joy, the stuff that creates that level of enthusiasm, comes from sort of a universal place. When you're sort of plugged into that, the rest kind of starts to fall away and take its proper level of importance, which is less and less in the big scope things. I used to say to guys when they were working for me, I'd say the first thing in the discussion of, you know, meeting subordinates in a supervisory role was, whatever we do here at the end of the day, it stays here, because this isn't going to define what you do that's really important to you in life, chances are, this job. The stuff you do when you leave here is, and this is going to provide you a way to do that. And really, I think if we start to look at a lot of aspects of our lives from that perspective, being able then to take those things that truly bring the spark of life to us as a place to really explode our creativity, we can do a lot. And in some of the most obscure places, you know, some people don't develop until they retire. You know, they hit that retirement age, and all of a sudden they go, oh, geez, now I can do whatever I want. And they find themselves busier than they ever were. But pursuing things that most people regret not pursuing much, much sooner. And that's where, again, I say, you know, pursue your interest, find a way to make a living at it. If you're blessed enough to do that, then you're way ahead of sort of the trap that most people find themselves in.
Is it different? And you've traveled around the world, right? So
right.
Is it different in other countries? Or is it just, I mean, I'm thinking, seeing life through the lens of an American, you know, and seeing that focus. And we work a lot. I mean, I know in this country, we don't put a lot of emphasis on time off. I mean, we don't work as much as some other countries, but we certainly are up there in the number
right.
of hours that we put in work versus leisure time versus Europeans get, what,
right.
like 6 or 8 or 12?
right.
Some crazy
right.
number. To me, it's like, whoa, wait a sec. They get a lot of time off. So what do you think it is?
I think it's a balancing act. Mm-hmm. Cultures, of course, do dictate a lot of that, for sure. And I think there's something to be said for the work ethic, you know, in terms of how we sort of structure our lives. At the same time, the idea of being able to use creative time to actually take a breath, what the Europeans do with these long breaks, I think it gives you a chance to really revitalize. You know, in some professions in the U.S. you have that. If you're in education, as an example, you've got a summer sort of revitalization period if you're a teacher or principal. You have breaks during the mid-year. If you're even college professors have that kind of a cycle, a break.
A sabbatical, right?
Right. right.
Yeah.
Kind of built into your
right.
your work life. But most of us don't do that. I mean, your sabbatical is at 62 and a half or 65 or 66 or whatever age now they kind of creep us up to say that we can finally stop. But I think it's really more important to find those things that invigorate us now, not in some future time that may or may not come. And I think that's the thing, again, that anchored for me as a very young person. You know, experiencing the loss of a parent at that age, it refocuses what is important to you relative to time, effort, and energy. Maybe it makes you too serious on some levels at that age. But having said that, it also brings some perspective on the possibilities and takes away the limits that otherwise are there.
You know, and what about this time? And this time in history right now, could there be a more inspirational time to be alive and to engage creatively with life?
I think it's been, you know, it is a great time to be alive. You know, a lot of the work I've done and people that know some of my work is primarily around technologies and sort of the analysis of technology impact on that, on living beings and conscious beings. You know, when you think about what is man really all about, it's, you know, we're sort of trying to duplicate what nature does, and we kind of do it with a sledgehammer approach when the feather's probably all that's necessary. But all the same, it's kind of this creative, you know, impetus that we all have as human beings. And today we've taken technologies to a level where they start to mirror a lot of the possibilities. But again, remember, they're a mirror of our own innate capability as human beings.
Has our maturity as a society matched the rate of technological advance?
I don't think so. I think we're, you know, and I've used the analogy, you know, we're like kindergartners running around with a hand grenade. We're hoping.
Are you sure it's not a nuclear weapon?
Yeah. We don't want to pull the pin, you know. And I think we are in a lot of our technology in that respect. And even as it evolves, you know, our laws don't keep up with it. I mean, think about privacy as an institution, you know. I mean, it's sort of dissolved with the internet and with mass communications and with the kinds of things that we now do with data banking and data storage of huge amounts of information. Something that wasn't anticipated, you know, as sort of the fallout from a more technological society, at least not at the level in which we're experiencing it. And we really haven't caught up, you know, and I think that's just one area. If you think of all the areas of technology, whether it has to do with impacts to the planet in terms of environmentally or socially, the impacts on human beings, you know, you say, do you see this around the world? Well, every culture is so dramatically different. What I see is billions and billions of people on the planet trying to catch up with where they think we are. And maybe where we are isn't exactly where the rest of the world needs to be right now.
Well, it seems like on one level we have, you know, the human potential movement. We have a great sensitivity to humanitarian issues, and a certain population really care about that. On the other hand, we have this modernist values of expansion, development, industrialization, also very strong, and seeming to have no bounds and pacing forward ever more quickly. And so it seems like there's just incredible opportunity, and there's also peril. And how do we, and there's also increased capacity for us all to communicate and connect globally, people with shared interests.
Right.
It seems like there's never been a moment in history where one person could make a difference just through their own inspiration and capacity to connect with like-minded people who are holding a higher narrative for their lives. And so I wanted to see if you had some comments.
I think that is really a really valuable thing to point out, because anyone can plug in literally to the mind of the world. I mean, and have an impact on it. And it's, you know, we started our work in the writing and the publication. The internet was just starting to come into its own place, and fax machines were, you know, really just getting to in common use. I mean, I remember the first fax machines I bought for the Anchorage School District were $7,500 each.
Wow.
You know, and so, I mean, but it saved money because you didn't have to have couriers running paperwork around and all this stuff, you know. But when you look at just simple things in technology and where we are today and where that takes us, it's changing every aspect of how we interact with each other. The humanity in it shifts also, but the possibilities are, I think, magnified, and the possibilities for individuals are huge.
I'm thinking about things like Twitter. I just started tweeting, you know, a couple of months ago, because I'm involved with a bunch of people who are anti-whale captivity activists, and we're getting information out via Twitter. And I've been on Facebook for a long time, which is another social network, but Twitter, the speed of Twitter, it's like you're connected into everybody's nervous system.
Right.
So at first I didn't get it, like, why, who wants to tweet? But there's a way in which it's like ping pong. You're just passing information back and forth, and after a while it starts to feel like you're hooked into this global nervous system. And you can see if, you know, 200 people are following you and a couple people pick that up and they pass your thing on and then they pass it on, you know, that the information just travels in lightning speed. It's amazing.
It is, not just on the internet, but, you know, when you think about the number of cable networks, the number of independent productions now that are out there that are being produced. More material can be laid out, and a million people can see it in a couple of days, you know, just the way things spread. I think that is, you know, unique. I mean, PBS did a special. It was on the worldwide mind, taking it the next level. What happens when you don't need the hardware? That you connect people in that
way.
Yeah,
we just got modems built in, right?
Right, and this is, I think we already do. I think naturally we do.
Yep.
And so, again, man is sort of recreating what we already have. And, you know, with that, that view, that idea of full connectivity of human beings, that has, you know, maybe some scarier ramifications as well when you think about it being mechanical as opposed to the natural flow of people are connected already in this way. And I think this is that emergence, that change that people are sensing today.
You're reminding me of a story. Have you read Douglas Adams' The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series? Is it okay? There's a great story in there about this race of people on some planet, I can't remember where, but they had what they called the curse of telepathy, and they could read each other's minds. And so they didn't like the fact that they could read each other's minds, so they had to have this constant stream of nonsense going back and forth so that they couldn't hear what was going on in each other's minds. So it is, it's sort of like there's a way in which you have to be vulnerable vulnerable if you're going to connect with people on that level. There has to be sort of nothing to protect in a way. You have to be more open.
Maybe that is, you know, that the next evolution. In fact, I did this conference when I was working for the Lay Institute on Technology on mind effects, and we had Rosalie Bertel, who's a physicist and mathematician. She's also, I forget which order, but she's a nun. And her view of the next evolution of humankind is this jump to these extrasensory perceptions, or now what they call anomalous human potentials is a, sort of the new phrase for this, because I guess ESP had too many bad connotations. But the idea that maybe we are able to really consciously create in a much more vigorous way. But if you think about telepathy, what occurs in one sense? Because you do have to be transparent. You have to be very forgiving, forgive yourself, forgive others, if you could really, truly see into the heart and mind of another human
being. Think about it.
Being.
Nobody could lie. Right. I mean, there would be no lying. If
they're straight out the politics of the planet,
exactly.
Wouldn't it?
Exactly. You know, let's do it.
It would be Judgment Day, actually. See, because you have to judge yourself, you got to judge others,
right.
And then transparency has a whole new meaning in the context of politics, social movements, everything. And, you know, maybe that is the evolution. You know, I certainly was surprised because a group of people that we had around that table, there was a general consensus that this is the next evolution of humankind, the awareness of what we can do. So when you start out talking about the trap we're in is one we each individually create, and the one we create can either be the trap or the box, or we can say there is no box and start doing things a little bit differently.
Yeah, and I think it just ultimately comes down to, what do we take ourselves to be? And if we're really identified with our personal history, our crazy minds, and we're going to start acting out from that place, and it's going to be quite limited. But if we really start to explore, I mean, geez, if there was telepathy, everybody would see how crazy everybody else is, right? I mean, half the stuff is going through our minds. We had no say in the matter. You know, sometimes we're consciously thinking things, but other times it's just nonsense that's cycling through repetitively. It's just a stressed nervous system.
Yeah, one of our friends is a folk singer, and he's got a great song. It's called "I've Got to Empty Out the Inside of My Head." And when he does the intro to the song, he's like, "It's my mind. Don't I get a say what's going on in there?" But you know, sometimes you don't. And the thing is, I think what makes you a sane person is that you don't choose to act based on everything that's going through your brain. And you know that. And that one of our teachers has said, when you've got the serial killer in their court appearance, and the judge says, "Well, why did you kill those 14 women?" And the guy says, "Well, this little voice in my head told me to do it." Well, why'd you listen to it? You know, and I think a lot of people are confused, and they think that voice in their head, you know, because we can get so identified with our minds and our experience and our conditioning and all that we think that's who we are. And then, you know, and then people act based on those things. But how do you determine, you know, you have to have some moral compass in there. You have to have something set in terms of, yes, this is okay to act on, and no, this isn't. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true. All of that's true. And I think it's our own habituation, if you will, to whatever patterns we fall into. You know, start out, we've had my granddaughter coming in and out during this interview.
Yeah, throwing paper airplanes
reminder.
At you while you're
right.
talking.
So it's like the reminder of what we really are. And at the essence, we're just these kids experiencing these things that we think are so... radically important, but really in the perspective of child to an adult. Again, they don't define who we are, each of these little events in the course of our work. We're much more than that. I think if we start to recognize what we are, then ability to achieve truly great things as individuals is certainly possible. In fact, it's the outcome.
Right, and I think when a lot of what's come through in what you're saying is agency. There's a certain volition and deliberateness that you've used to guide your life, and it's come quite naturally to you. You know, and I think that's a key, is that we can literally create according to our intention. You know,
absolutely. It's the only way it happens. I mean, the thing is, we do a lot of it as unconscious, so we kind of falling into patterns. We can create really well destructively, it seems like. You know, most people can. But we can do the same thing constructively, and it's a matter of choice, as simple as that, and really directed energy.
That's a great note to take a break on.
Thanks. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Nick Begich. And if you have questions, please send them to us on Facebook.
Yeah, go to Bridge to Everywhere on the Facebook page, and just type your question into Nick there. And we'll look forward to catching you in a few minutes.
Community radio is what you make it. If you want to be involved with Radio Free Palmer, contact us on the web, radiofreepalmer.org. We're looking for ideas, we're looking for volunteers, and we're looking for help. Thank you so much, and enjoy. program is made possible in part by KVRF members and the generosity of Silva Insurance, specializing in finding tailored insurance covering all your personal and business-related insurance needs, including health insurance and employee benefits. Silva Insurance, located from across from the Palmer City Hall at 234 West Evergreen in Palmer. Call 746-2990 or visit their website, www.silvainsurance.net.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Bridge to Everywhere with Kevin and Sam. And we are interviewing Dr. Nick Begich. We're talking about conscious creativity. And we're going to take a look at emerging technologies. We want to look at what's happening and what it maybe means for the world that we're growing into. So we have nanotechnology, we have biotechnology, we have three-dimensional printing. I mean, this is something I saw in an expo on a video not too long ago where they printed a motorcycle, a fully operational motorcycle, using three-dimensional printing technologies that really worked. And then we also have, of course, internet technology. We have social networking.
You can add in robotics.
Robotics, and artificial intelligence.
And Nick's written a book on mind control.
And mind control. So we have all of this happening, and we've all agreed at this point that we don't have necessarily the maturity, the depth to fully appreciate maybe what we're actually moving in towards. So maybe we could talk a little bit about those technologies, where they're heading, and... what do you see in the future?
The thing about just the mind itself and information, you know, think about how much information a human mind can process compared to, you know, a computer as an example. And we are infinitely more powerful. In fact, we're like, we are in fact super computers, human beings, each individual. Now, what does that mean if we want to compare ourselves to hardware? And the fastest computers a few years ago were about 280 teraflops a second, which is the equivalent of 6 billion people with hand calculators every 5 seconds making a calculation for 60 hours, and that computer, a modern computer, will do that in 1 second. Okay, now...
okay, hold on a second.
Hold that for
like,
a second,
whoa.
Okay?
I'm counting grains of sand on the beach, okay?
60 hours.
Okay.
60 hours.
All right.
Every human being on the planet with a calculator every 5 seconds doing a calculation makes 1 second of a modern computer. A supercomputer in the style that they're looking at in the future, these quantum computers, they will do what our supercomputer today does in a trillion years in 1 hour. So when you start to think about what are we, we're the supercomputer that does that thing in 1 hour. Okay, if we can ever really understand that and plug into that possibility, that gives you a little better connection with, you know, who we each are. So when we start to look at ourselves from standpoints of limits, it really doesn't line up with the bio circuits, if you will, or anything else about our nature. And then what we're discovering is that we're not just a closed system. We're not just this system that operates within the shell we call our body, but that we extend out beyond that and we're connected to everything else in some fundamental way. And so when you start to think about sort of the resolution of how we look at each other as human beings, that resolution increases over millennium, but more recently over very short durations of time as we get sort of a bigger picture. So like when we talked about telepathy before the break, the military through DARPA actually led a couple of contracts, University of California, to look at this, where they were going to model a brain in real time so they can look at it in three dimensions, imaging during a real thought, and then take that sort of image, that energy distribution across that brain, and then impose it on another brain. Well, to do that, you got to have real high computing capacity to be able to capture that signal and then to be able to recreate it and impose it. And the idea is that you'll be able to create a bank of memory sets and then be able to transfer them to other individuals for training purposes or for disrupting your adversaries. So when you start to think about, you know, there's some great possibilities, but at the same time, when you start to think about what can be done with this type of technology.
So could this
different.
Be like the Matrix technology where somebody says, well, I want to learn to be a Kung Fu master, and they can just plug in a CD?
That's the idea. That's the idea, and it's called controlled effects. In fact, there was a publication. It was a June 2004 issue of Technology Horizon, which is produced by the Electromagnetic Directorate of the Air Force, wrote this particular article, and it was on controlled effects, which are to duplicate memory sets by being able to recreate all the basic five senses in such a way that you can create complete experiences that you couldn't distinguish one synthesized experience set from, you know, the real experience. So then you got things start to pop up, like, well, what do you do with rules of evidence in court hearings in 30 or 40 years when this technology is available, and maybe sooner? You know, what do you do when people have the ability to sort of look into what you're thinking without necessarily your consent or your informed consent, or to be able to impose on another person some emotional state or some specific idea?
You can just see people checking out like they would on a drug. You know, if you could do that, like, you could just have whatever experience you want to have, kind of like your own personal holodeck. And then, you know, people, so in a way, people are not, they're not really contributing to the process anymore. They're just like people could check out, you know, by being addicted to anything, they could become addicted to that.
Ultimate reality TV, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, a real waste of time.
Yeah.
But it is that. I mean, and when you think about it, even gaming today, when you look at gaming, the way they used to do it is you would get a bunch of kids or a bunch of people that was your target audience. They'd play the game, and then you'd get their feedback with questionnaires and interviews and that kind of thing. Today, they don't do that. They actually monitor brain activity in real time to see what particular brain centers are firing. So the ones that affect, you know, the adrenal glands, that get you excited, that get you the complete recreation of a real experience, but it's completely synthetic. But your body goes through all of the chemical and biological shifts that you would had you experienced the real event. Now, as you get the ability to do this, you can create addictions to games, just in the same way as you can fire the centers that are responsible for addictive behaviors, whether it's cigarettes or heroin, and trigger the same kinds of chemical releases using gaming then becomes the addiction.
We were talking to somebody who's a math expert yesterday, who's going to be on the show in a couple of weeks, and he was saying when that email ding comes into your into your box, that actually there's a little bit of a dopamine release from that. You know, that they've monitored that, so that's already in play. You know, that we're already doing that. We're already doing a little bit of self medicating when that, oh, I've got mail. My Twitter account, or there's that little one on my Facebook account, whatever it is. People are already responding to that, so it's not like that's a
addicted to the little red number on the Facebook top there. Yeah.
Yep.
Hey, the other thing is, I just saw an article where there's a dopamine release in the harvest. When you actually go out and harvest vegetables, they found that that's actually a dopamine release. And
hey, there's a charge to getting something from the earth, isn't there? Yeah. I mean, really. I mean, if you think about whether you're fishing, whether you're harvesting produce from your garden or whatever you're doing, when you're engaged with the earth and you're extracting something from it, it's giving up something for you. I think there is a charge. We feel it. You know, when you actually look at brain activity when you're experiencing different things, whether it be music, and you look at what brain activity does, different kinds of music, you know, whether you're in a crowded city or whether you're in a remote, quiet place, and you start to look at that total relationship between you and your surroundings. When we started the show, you fall into a routine. You become the rhythm of your surroundings, the rhythm of those people that you surround yourself with. If you think about consciously looking out at sort of your relationships generally, sort of where you started all, are they healthy ones? You know, are they ones you need to change? Are they ones you need to alter? And in that alteration, huge shifts begin to happen in terms of synchronicity, random events that sort of fall your way, as we say.
Right.
It's really directed more by your own intention, your own effort, than most of us ever realize, but it's taking deliberate steps in that direction. And at the same time, not being so connected to the result, I mean, so fearful of the result in most cases, but recognizing the doing of those things that bring you some sense of balance and expression. Yeah, it's probably a good thing.
Yeah, well, a lot of people won't start because they've got a fear of failure, but other people won't start because they actually have a fear of success.
Yeah, I think that's true, too. And because people look around, they see people who have so-called succeeded, and they don't look like they live very happy lives, and so that is true. And I've met some extraordinarily successful people in my life. I've met billionaires with a B in my life, and some of them are the most unhappy people that I've met in my life. Something that you would not consider if you think materialism brings a person happiness. You'd be surprised at how little it does contribute.
Well, we often say there's two ways of being unhappy. One is not getting what you want, and two is getting what you want. So it just shows you that it has to be about more than just, you know, money or fame or even some level of achievement. Like, it has to be bigger than just about you. Because I think that example that you gave is that pretty much everybody I know can come up with some example of somebody who they think has it all and is absolutely miserable.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, and it's true. And I think we tend to project out on other people a lot of things that are internal to ourselves. And again, it's I think it's finding the pleasure in the things that you do that bring you joy, finding a way to make a living at it as a bonus. It doesn't have to be. But I think that's the way it changes. And then your associations change by virtue of how you sort of redirect your energy. And I think that matters. I believe in that sort of group karmic sort of effect, you know, and the idea of always engaging in a combat. You know, you see moving from one place to another, now you're in a conflict with the place you once were. I don't believe in that. I think that's part of the problem. That's why we keep falling into these same cycles of moderate successes and moderate failures, when really sort of stepping out of that, recognizing neither define us, and that's what I had said earlier, you know, these big things, these important things, or these really disastrous things don't define us.
There's a TED Talk. Yeah, I'm going to put you for the microphone. There's a TED Talk, the Technology, Entertainment, and Design, where they compared lottery winners with amputees. Right. With people who had lost a limb in a car accident or some kind of accident, and they compared them for their happiness at year, like right at the moment when they were, became lottery winners or amputees, and then a year later, and they actually found no difference.
Yeah, that's
so
interesting.
I mean,
yeah.
To me, that just says it all.
It.
Yeah.
And it does, because none of these things really define us, and yet we experience them with lots of emotional charge, you know, whatever. I mean, if you were in either of those situations, a lot of emotional charge, which gives some coloration and some texture to what we're experiencing, but still it doesn't define us. And I think, again, if you can sort of step back from that, recognize the emotional flow of those bad and those good things as they happen, we'll be able to step back a little bit from them from an observer perspective and not let them take you with them. Maybe that's the first step to awakening, to recognizing that there's another way, not always getting caught up in that same pattern, but seeing it. And in the seeing it, you've actually taken control of it. And I think that's what most of us don't realize. It's as simple as that.
And some of that can be very subtle. I mean, you can be in a conversation with a group and find that you don't have access to resources, creativity, ideas, inspiration that you might have access to with other people. And so that sort of quality of consciousness, you know, it feels like it maybe puts a damper on what's possible. But I want to ask you how much of that is just because we don't want to be victims of that either. We don't want to be limited by, and that's the question, is there's some aspects of physiology and, you know, that affect our experience and our perceptions. But we're ultimately, I get a little uncomfortable with science because it begins to make me a victim of my biology.
It limits us. Right. Yeah, I agree with that.
And so how is it that we conduct or position ourselves in a way that we are aware of the subtle effect that others may have or situations might have, but not be victims of it, still maintain our creative integrity, but recognize that we are in relationship and ultimately we can only do things together. We're not islands.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's maybe perspective on how entangled you become in other people's dramas. Mm. You know, I mean, you can respect everyone's existence. You can even work with a lot of people in a lot of different ways. But how far do you choose to engage, to entangle yourself in their drama is our own individual choice. And I think that's, again, if you're attracted and you're working with people that are positively motivated or engaged, like what they're doing, genuinely love their work, enjoy the people that are around, you'll find yourself tremendously more uplifted because that basic enthusiasm, basic joy that comes from that same root place. On the other hand, you find yourself in these other patterns. You find yourself habituated to depressed states of existence right. because that's the people you're around. And I really think it's that fundamental. You can still be around them, but you can still step sort of out of it. You know, you're in your workplace, you're doing your routine, you've been doing it forever. You recognize where you're at. You begin to take some positive steps to move a different direction, whether it's getting more education, whether it's doing the things that really bring you joy outside of work, and then focusing on the relationships that bring you joy, that bring you true happiness in the sense of identification of your own sort of inner self.
That's great. And then when you're with people that are actually really reaching out creative in the way that we're speaking about, it's almost like the ceiling gets blown off.
It does.
And you find access to insights, creativity, ideas that you just didn't have access to as an individual.
That's right. In fact, most people, most creative people that I've worked with, what they experience is a sense of isolation because, you know, a lot of the people I work with are scattered all over the planet, and we get to see each other once a year, twice a year, maybe if we're lucky. But the attempt to make the communications work. Now you have Skype, phones are cheap or free. The ability to do that, like what you were alluding to earlier, anyone can do that now. The ability to network people literally around the world that have similar interests. And I think we're going to see more of sort of that forming a very different way of looking at things. So a friend of mine, very creative guy, brilliant guy, was falling into this sort of, a lot of people do, this sort of fatalistic thinking. You know, it's 2012, the sky is falling. You know, before it was Y2K and before it was a communist threat. Or whatever, you know, the deal is. And how easy it is for highly creative people to fall into that. And, you know, this is where those of us that kind of have our own circle of influence, if you will, actually can have an impact on each other. We can kind of keep each other from falling into those traps and lifting each other up. And this is, again, the quality of your relationships dictates that. The quality of your family life to a great deal dictates that. But we make the individual choices ultimately about how we live and how we choose to live. And whether or not we stay in the trap. My brother Tom used to describe my life to people and say, oh, Nick thinks out of the box, Nick thinks out of the box. And finally I stopped him one day and I said, Tom, there is no box, because you think there is one, you're still in it. And it really is true. And the same is with our lives. If we just can step back just a little bit, recognize the things that we're doing don't define us so rigidly, then maybe we can find a way through those experiences to bring ourselves back to the things that truly bring us joy.
Yeah, it seems like it requires a subtle level of awareness that there are some things that are habituated in our life that serve a purpose. You know, but we don't want inertia. We don't want that to permeate the important parts of our life. But there was another thing you brought up just about sort of the group. There's a concept called senius that was a word coined by Brian Eno, a musician. And he talked about how the music scene in Greenwich Village in the 60s, like everybody thinks of Bob Dylan as a genius, and like somehow he's a genius that just, you know, lucky guy and inspired as an individual. But this concept of senius is, no, there was a scene happening. There was a sort of creative dynamic between incredibly passionate people that were all inspired to sort of push the edge, and they fed off of each other. And so in that creative friction between inspired individuals, they're able to sort of blast out into something new happened, and then they just really went with it. And so that happened in the Renaissance. You know, there's different times in history where that's happened. And now we can kind of see that dynamic. We could maybe consciously create that kind of environment.
It's happening now, and it is being created now. I think there's a lot of people I know around the world involved in politics, economics, science, are doing that deliberately, taking the time to network with people they previously wouldn't have, just because you can. Mm-hmm. And then from that, and the primary objective is not doing the business, not creating the social change, not creating the economic, you know, shift. The real effort is creating the relationship. And then from that, seeing what happens, which is a very different way of approaching things, is the value of the relationship is primary. Not what comes from it, not what is created out of it, not what might spring from it as a result, but just a very act of finding like-minded people with a similar worldview, and then that ends up being expressed into real action, into real doing, in a much more synergistic way than any individual would have ever imagined. And it's happening now. There's a lot of people doing that consciously now.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And that's authentic. So there's an authenticity that comes from that. So mostly in our culture, it's about what can we get out of this? What can we, you got this talent, I got this talent. Let's see what we can create that's going to generate a product somebody will pay for.
Can we charge for this?
And how much? So that's sort of, you know, the modernist values and, you know, just of profit making. And so this deeper humanitarian sort of connection, obviously it makes so much sense that would actually generate a result that would have more power, be more impactful, and actually be a greater thing to be a part of.
It works better, because really it does work better, because you'll find that 90% of the time gets occupied by 10% of your issues, which are the problem issues, could be avoided if the relationships were solid to begin with. So you end up spending most of your time doing productive work and a lot less time being distracted. And that's where it fundamentally becomes more important. And this is that underlying sort of thing that ties us together. And then, I mean, what brought us here to do this radio thing today was, you know, we never have time to talk to each other. At least we carved out an hour. and it's true, because you really have to carve out the time for the relationships that are important to you, and whether it be with a phone call or a Skype or doing a radio show, whatever it takes, because really, at the end of the day, that those are the things that, that really blossom in, to real things that change the world, change ourselves, and we can really amplify the good in each other coming from that perspective. And then recognize the places that individually we need to grow. And we do that on the base of healthy relationships. But fundamentally, whether it's business, science, the arts, politics even, it's all based on relationships, ultimately.
I think there's a bit of a myth in our culture that we're as the individual, we're supposed to do it all. Like, it's sort of, there's a lot of things that you as the individual do have to take responsibility for, but really, we're standing on the shoulders of everybody who's come before us. And right. All of these ideas are from people around us. Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Outliers, is a wonderful book. It talks about what it takes to become successful. And he looks at what made the Beatles. You know, what made the Beatles? And part of what made the Beatles was they got 10,000 hours of practice in Germany.
Right.
Before they went to Germany, they were not the Beatles, you know, and they just happened to have this opportunity, and they got 10,000 hours of doing this thing over and over and over again that they really loved, and they became something amazing, you know. And then there's also, just like you said, synchronicities show up and an opportunity, but it's not just, a lot of people are kind of thinking like, the opportunity is going to come up and then I'm going to be great. But it's like there's all this work that you have to put in on your own. And then there's also all these connections that have to be made. Like it's this dynamic thing. It's not just, you know, I as an individual are going to, I'm going to do it all myself and I'm going to figure it out on my own. And that's it.
Yeah. The hard work is maybe 60% of it. Mm-hmm. And then 40% of it is what you don't know about and the things that surprise you. And I think that's probably right for most of us. And you never do it alone. I mean, never do anything alone. It's always on the strength of the people that you have around you. And I think that's, again, the sort of the focus, again, is you look at how healthy are your relationships. Are they really supporting what you're doing? Are you supporting what they're doing, you know, for that matter? And there are points of separation where you really have to pull yourself away from the circumstance that you're in, make conscious decisions to head a different direction. And you can do it in increments. Don't do what's scary and what you view as impossible because you'll never achieve it. Do the necessary things, things you see right in front of you that are obvious, and do those steps. And that's where most people get confused. They think they got to get to the finish line. The finish line is out there. You have to have it in mind, but the steps you believe in that you know absolutely you can accomplish, that's where the essence of faith is found, and the accomplishment of small things lead to the success in the larger things. That's where it happens, not on getting lost in sort of the bigness of things, but recognizing that there really aren't any big things or small things.
I think it's funny, too. Sometimes if you don't know something's impossible, that you don't have that fixed idea that you can actually do it. I had, early on in my acupuncture career, I was treating a lot of women with hot flashes with just acupuncture because I wasn't trained originally as an herbalist. And I was talking to another herbalist, and he was saying, you know, I would never treat hot flashes without, or you can't treat hot flashes with acupuncture. I'm like, oh, nobody told me that. Yeah. But I mean, that happens so much and I think that's what Kevin was talking about limits. Cause you have to be careful just because you learn something new and you're really into understanding how things work. And I want to learn more and more, and I want to get this degree and I want to get that degree.
Right.
Like how is that supporting you to move forward? And how is that also creating limits about what you can do and what you can't do?
Well, writing books, you know, I was thinking I was into writing books when I was old and gray. Well, I finally got some gray hair. I didn't have it when I started. But the whole concept of doing it, if I had been told that the average book sold only 7,000 copies in its life, would I have written the first book? Probably not. But it did really well. So, and we ended up writing five of them, and they've done really well.
How many copies did the first book sell?
The first book sold over 100,000.
Wow,
copies. So it did.
So
really,
more than 10 times as much as
anyone's
supposed
to do. Yeah. And so I felt pretty good about that, you know. And and we're in 9 languages now with the books that we've written. And the thing about it all is again, it's what did I believe I could do? Well, I did that. And the next thing showed itself, and the next thing, and before you know it, you know, 17 years rolls by, and you look back, and well, that's pretty interesting, 17 years. And it was, truly, and has been. And what's coming in the next 17 is going to be just as interesting, I'm sure. I think it's recognizing there are no limits but those that we impose on ourselves, and we do it so well. If we just could recognize that we can do the opposite so well.
That's great. I've got a story from a friend of mine who spontaneously developed the capacity to paint like a true master. She just, I mean, she had like, you know, never right. really pursued it, you know, as a kid and growing up. But then just as a later, you know, in her adult life, she decided to take a class. And the first class was, you know, sort of a ho-hum. She kind of dabbled a little bit. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, somebody sent her a beautiful photograph and, you know, on her cell phone or something. And she just got the inspiration to start painting it. And she blew out the most incredible lifelike painting, and she's been firing these things out like nothing.
Well, right. And I looked at that. I said, "Do you have anything that you can show me that you've done?" She said, "Sure," and she gave me her cell phone to look at the pictures. And I'm flipping through. I said, "These are the photos, right?" And she said, "No, those are the paintings."
Couldn't tell the difference.
You really couldn't tell the difference.
It was a talent that was latent, and it was just spontaneously. She had room in it. She was, you know, she wasn't convinced that she wasn't good. She didn't, you know, she had no feeling one way or the other, and she just let it come through. And then the other point, I think, is that she, once that talent came through, she was able to hold it.
Right.
Which is a point that you're making.
Yeah, and again, belief system got out of the way. You know, now she believes she's an artist and she is one. You know?
Yeah.
She didn't, no doubt in her mind, because she did it. And I think that really does tie a lot in. You know, a friend of mine, Eldon Taylor, has written several books on beliefs and reality creation. And there's a number of physicists that are looking at this now. And we actually do create the reality. On the fundamental physics of it, is it a particle or is it a wave? Is it substance or is it energy? The observer determines to a large degree that. We are, in fact, creating the reality on the most fundamental level, and then how we project that out. Our belief systems are the framework for the realities we create and how we limit ourselves or grant ourselves the freedom to explore the world in a more interesting and creative way.
So now you're going back to personal responsibility again.
That's right.
Because you really have to take responsibility for what, you know, if you've got limiting beliefs, you know, you're responsible for those. And
That's
if you
right.
don't, you're responsible for that too. So you
That's
really
right.
have to look at those things and say, where am I creating my own limits?
Yeah, and it is. It's all about that. And I think fundamentally it's about that. And the changes that happen, once you accept the possibility of synchronicity as an example, you find that you're either seeing it more often, and it was always there, or it's just showing up more often. It doesn't really matter which, because you are picking it out of the ether, so to speak, and acting on it. But that has a lot to do with your beliefs. If you don't believe it's possible, if you believe you're trapped, if you believe that's where you're going to be, guaranteed that's where you're going to stay.
Great. So we're coming down to the last minute of the show. Is there anything you can say about what your projects in the future, where you're heading?
Well, I've been writing, again, a lot different stuff than the science and technology, and you guys have shared some of that. I've shared some of that with you. And again, turning that creativity in different directions in my own life, and I'm at that crossroads again where I'm doing it. Still involved in a lot of, you know, a lot of technology. I don't lose that interest. But again, it is as simple as changing channels on the television. It's time to change channels, and a lot of us have channels to change. And this is a good year to do it. 2012, a year of transformation, not a year of doom and gloom. I think people who focus on that will see that the year will come and go. But how we engage it is really up to us as individual human beings, and how we engage it as a community. We have great opportunities in 2012.
That's a beautiful
That's
note
awesome.
To finish on. And if folks want to follow up with your work, what's the best way for them to find out?
Check the website out, earthpulse.com, EARTHPULSE, earthpulse.com.
Great. We want to thank everyone for joining us this evening on Bridge to Everywhere. And in 2 weeks, we'll have Peter House demystifying math. So please tune in.
<All right. laughs>
Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.